From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Russia's prime minister visits Crimea, efforts continuing to revive the Mideast peace talks, fears of the deadly Ebola virus rising in West Africa, plus wearable electronic bandage monitoring movement disorders. In the news, it was a surprise visit to Crimea on Monday by the Russian prime minister, the Kiev government at the same time denouncing the visit, which came as Russian troops began withdrawing from Ukraine's border after weeks of military tension. VOA's Daniel Scharf reporting now from Kiev.
Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev on Monday led a delegation of top Russian ministers to Crimea. It was the highest-level visit by a Russian leader since Moscow seized the territory earlier this month from Ukraine. Russia's actions and military buildup along Ukraine's border raised alarm bells in Europe and the United States and set off fears of a renewed Cold War between the East and West. But Russian forces Monday began pulling back from the border, though officials in Ukraine remain on alert. Ukraine's acting president, Oleksandr Turchinov, spoke at a National Guard training unit outside Kiev. He says they will provide significant funding for military forces and for the National Guard to protect the country. If they do not do this, he says, hope for any kind of external help would not be reasonable. He says Ukraine has to have a powerful military and National Guard so they can meet any aggression with a strong response. Russia seized Crimea following a controversial referendum on March 16th. Ukraine, the United States, and European Union call Moscow's actions on Crimea dangerously destabilizing and illegitimate. Moscow claims it was protecting the majority Russian population from persecution by Ukrainian nationalists. The United Nations on Friday voted 100-11 on a resolution declaring the referendum illegal. In the Black Sea Peninsula's capital, Simferopol, Prime Minister Medvedev pledged the people of Crimea will only benefit under Russian rule. He announced plans to upgrade social benefits, transportation, and infrastructure. He said the government also will reduce administrative procedures to attract investors. He says the goal is to make the peninsula as attractive to investors as possible to generate enough income for its own development. Such a possibility exists. He says they have considered all this, and that is why they made a decision to create a special economic zone there. Ukraine's foreign ministry denounced the visit as a crude violation of international norms. Russia's Black Sea Fleet is stationed in Crimea, where for the past 2 weeks Russian forces surrounded and expelled Ukrainian troops. Crimean Tatars on Saturday announced plans to vote for autonomy within the region. The Muslim minority in the past suffered under Russian rule and was expelled by Soviet leader Joseph Stalin. About a third of Crimea's population are retirees who depend on pensions. Many of them supported Russia's taking back the territory, which it gave to Ukraine 60 years ago when it was part of the Soviet Union. Despite coming under Russian rule, Crimea still depends on Ukraine for most of its food, water, and electricity. Power cuts to the region last week were blamed on pressure from Kiev. Prime Minister Medvedev says the government is working to develop alternative sources, including better connections to Russia. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Kiev.
Ukraine's new leaders say they will release the preliminary report this week on the February 20th sniper shootings of anti-government protesters in Kiev's Independence Square. Protest leaders worry the investigation might be flawed. We get more now from Jamie Detmer in Kiev.
Boris Asiev, a 45-year-old web designer, is explaining how he was shot three times in Kiev's Independence Square, known as the Maidan. He had camped out in the Maidan for 3 months along with thousands of others, trying to oust Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. On February the 20th, he was one of hundreds of protesters wounded in the shooting that erupted and lasted most of the day. Two rounds from an AK-47 tore into his leg. The third was in the same leg but appears to have been fired by a sniper. He was one of the fortunate ones. At least 53 anti-government protesters were killed on February the 20th, according to Ukraine's Ministry of Health, many dying within minutes from rounds fired by expert marksmen that targeted the head, neck or heart. The shootings have become a major dispute in a propaganda war between supporters of the ousted Yanukovych, including the Kremlin, and the Maidan revolutionaries and Ukraine's interim government. Last week, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov repeated Kremlin allegations that the snipers were either right-wing extremists or foreign mercenaries hired by the Maidan protesters seeking to discredit Yanukovych, who fled Kiev the day after the shootings. Ukraine's new justice minister, Pavlo Petrenko, formerly an opposition member of parliament, says he has no doubt who gave the orders to shoot protesters.
It was the decision of Yanukovych and his government to make these things. It's my opinion and my feeling.
He says that a probe being overseen by the country's new prosecutor general and new head of Ukraine's intelligence service, the SBU, is making progress.
Our police and general prosecutor make all these things, and I think that during some few weeks we'll have some first answers on these questions about those people who were on this building and who had these comments. And nevertheless, the first question is who gave them comment to shoot.
But many of the Maidan leaders are critical of the investigation. Many suspect the SBU was involved in the shootings. Photographs published over the weekend by the Daily Beast website show anti-terrorist and special forces units arming and preparing themselves on the morning of February the 20th at the SBU headquarters, just three blocks from the Maidan. Olga Bogomilets, one of the Maidan leaders and a medical doctor who treated the wounded on February the 20th, says there are problems with the SBU investigating itself and wants outsiders to oversee the probe.
I just think that we have to look for truth and we have to ask for independent organization, expert group, who will check the information and who will give Ukrainian people the true answer with no lie, because we are tired to live with the corruption and without truth. So this was the message.
Justice Minister Petrenko, who was with the protesters on February the 20th, understands the criticism, but says he has faith in the probe.
I don't think that it's a problem, because you know that in the Ukrainian parliament we made special commission. Mm-hmm. The main purpose of this commission is to control police and control the system of prosecutors in the investigation of all these crimes.
More than 100 people died and more than 500 wounded in the months of protests that led to Mr. Yanukovych fleeing the country and an interim government taking office. Most were protesters, but several police officers were among the casualties also. If the investigation into the February 20th deaths doesn't satisfy Maidan protesters, many say they will start demonstrating again, this time against the country's new leaders. If the investigation into the February 20th deaths doesn't satisfy Maidan protesters, many say they will start demonstrating again, this time against the country's new leaders. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kiev.
And you can keep up to date on what's happening in Ukraine plus the rest of the region by going to our website at voanews.com. Still ahead, the search for that missing Malaysian passenger plane.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Now the day of searching is about to begin for Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 that's been missing since about an hour after it took off from Kuala Lumpur International Airport on March 8th en route to Beijing with 227 passengers and 12 crew members aboard. Monday's search produced no new news about where the plane might be. Total of 10 aircrafts, 11 ships scoured an area of the southern Indian Ocean, about 1,850 kilometers west of Australia. Meantime, relatives of the missing passengers of Flight 370 continued their meetings with a Malaysian official delegation in a Beijing hotel on Monday. Steve Wan speaks on behalf of many of the Chinese families who have relatives who were aboard that flight. He said much of the information they have been given by Malaysian authorities and officials from Malaysian Airlines has been, in his words, totally useless. A spokesman for the Malaysian delegation meeting with the relatives responded.
Each and every question that you put forward to us, there won't be an answer. For sure. And we have said, the government has said, we will not stop looking for this answer. So my appeal to you is, please, let us finish this process.
Also on Monday, more than 100 family members gathered for a prayer vigil for the loved ones at a Beijing hotel where they have stayed for more than 3 weeks, waiting for more information about the investigation into what happened to that missing plane. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Israel trying to reach an agreement on a deal to extend Middle East peace talks that are threatened by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's reluctance to release more prisoners. VOA Scott Stearns reports that Secretary Kerry says it is time some judgments have to be made about going forward on a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
It's the second time in less than a week that Secretary Kerry's changed his schedule and come to the region to try to prevent peace talks from collapsing over the prisoner controversy. Israeli leaders want the peace process extended beyond the end of next month before they release more prisoners, arguing that Palestinians will have no incentive to continue with talks once the detainees are freed. Palestinians say they'll quit now if Israel refuses to release those prisoners, among them Israeli Arabs, detained before the 1993 Oslo Peace Accord. Israel promised to free this group as part of the deal that launched 9 months of peace talks in exchange for Palestinians agreeing not to take diplomatic action against Israel at international organizations such as the United Nations. As he has throughout these talks, Kerry declined to discuss publicly specifics of U.S. efforts to overcome the prisoner standoff.
I think it'd be inappropriate to get into any kind of judgments about what may or may not occur or happen, because it's really a question between the Palestinians and the Israelis and what Prime Minister Netanyahu is prepared to do.
Secretary Kerry met in Jordan with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas last Wednesday before returning to Italy to join President Barack Obama's meeting with Pope Francis. Talks here come between a late Sunday meeting in Paris with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and Tuesday's start of a NATO foreign ministers meeting in Brussels. Scott Stearns, VOA News, Tel Aviv.
Court in Israel has convicted former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert of bribery. It is the first such conviction of a head of government in Israeli history. VOA Scott Bob reports now from Jerusalem.
A court in Tel Aviv announced its decision Monday as part of a wide-ranging probe of corruption while former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was mayor of Jerusalem. He could face up to 10 years in prison. Mr. Olmert's lawyer, Roy Blecher, said he intends to appeal. He says it's not an easy day for us. There were four charges, and Mr. Olmert was exonerated on two of them. The charges follow a broad investigation into corruption in the construction of the Holy Land housing project. Prosecutors said millions of dollars changed hands illegally to promote the controversial venture, which included zoning law changes and tax breaks for its developers. A total of 13 officials and businessmen were charged in the case. Several are already serving prison sentences. It was the latest of the former leader's legal problems. Another court in 2012 convicted him of breaching the public trust by helping a former colleague win government contracts while Mr. Olmert was mayor of Jerusalem and subsequently Israel's trade and industry minister. He was acquitted on other more serious charges but received a suspended one-year sentence and a fine. Mr. Olmert was elected prime minister in 2006. He was forced to resign 3 years later because of scandals prompted by these and other corruption allegations. Scott Bob, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Amnesty International is saying 1,500 people have been killed this year in an escalating armed conflict between Boko Haram insurgents and Nigerian security forces. Heather Murdoch reports that Amnesty says more than half the victims were civilians.
Amnesty International calls the rising number of Boko Haram attacks truly shocking and the reaction of Nigerian security forces brutality. The rights group says both sides may have committed acts that may constitute war crimes and crimes against humanity. It calls for an investigation by the African Commission on Human and People's Rights and the UN Human Rights Council. Boko Haram, an Islamist militant group based in northeastern Nigeria, has been attacking government forces, churches, schools, markets, and mosques since it began violent operations in 2009. Three northeastern states have been under emergency rule for nearly 11 months, but Elizabeth Donnelly of the Africa Program at the London-based Policy Institute, Chatham House, says the attacks continue to get worse.
It has got more violent, and you've seen, I mean, it's such a range of targets, from communities to schools and such softer targets to actually real, really prominent military targets.
Rights groups have repeatedly accused Nigerian security forces of responding to the violence with extrajudicial killings and holding suspects in inhumane prison conditions for long periods of time without charges or trials. The Nigerian military denies these accusations and says no military in the world has devised a perfect plan to combat terrorists. Donnelly says the military also faces a constantly changing and growing insurgency that is difficult to combat because it has no clear leadership structure, funding sources, or focus.
Beyond that, there are lots of what you describe as what seems to be more peripheral elements to the organization that may well shift and change, interest motivations shift and change.
Boko Haram says it wants to impose its harsh version of Islamic law and ban all Western education. But its tactics and real motivations appear to be constantly changing, says Donnelly.
It is adapting, and adaptation means change. So this is a group in flux. But I think it's always going to be a group in flux, and I think it's quite key in terms of policy responses, knowing that.
Last week, Abubakar Shekau, the man who claims to lead the group, released a video taking credit for a recent attack on a military base and detention center. Amnesty International says it has credible evidence 600 people were killed after Boko Haram attacked Giwa barracks, and that most of the victims were detainees killed by soldiers. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
West Africans are growing more apprehensive as the region's first ever Ebola outbreak spreads. Guinea's president and other leaders are urging people to remain calm, but people across the region say they're simply scared. Jennifer Lazuda in Dakar is following the story.
The Ebola outbreak that began in Guinea's southeastern forest region last month is causing widespread fear as the death toll rises and the outbreak spreads. Leaders throughout the region have said that there is no reason to panic, but people say they are becoming increasingly worried. Steve Doe is a resident of Liberia's capital, Monrovia.
I'm afraid. I mean, the way it attacks one, you know, and the way it kills, you know, I'm afraid, you know, that the outbreak of it will be known in Liberia, or anywhere for that matter. We all are human beings, so yes, I'm afraid, yes.
Guinea's Ministry of Health says more than 70 people have died since the first suspected case was treated on February 9th. More than 125 people across three countries are now believed to have been affected by the highly contagious virus. Guinea's Ministry of Health confirmed last week that the virus had made its way to the capital, Conakry. Aid organizations say this is a worrying development, as Conakry is a densely populated city and many people lack access to water and good sanitation. In Liberia, at least two people have tested positive for Ebola. Sierra Leone has also reported suspected cases of the virus. On Saturday, Senegal closed the land border it shares with Guinea in the southeast of the country as a preventative measure. Papa Konate, who lives in Dakar, said he is scared that this may not be enough.
Ebola is a malady. Given it has surprised beaucoup de monde, quoi. Donc bien sûr qu'on a peur, bien sûr qu'on se méfie.
He says Ebola is a disease that can affect anyone, so of course we are afraid. We pass people on the streets and then we enter into our homes. And you see, here in Dakar, there are many Ghanaians everywhere. He says you have many Ghanaians who come and go, who leave and come back without a problem. It's risky. Health officials say the Ebola cases that were found in Liberia can be traced back to individuals who recently traveled to Guinea. There is no vaccine against Ebola and no medication to cure it. The virus is spread through close contact with the bodily fluids, such as sweat, blood, or saliva, of an infected person or animal. Doctors say the only way to contain the outbreak is to stop further infections. Monrovian resident Amiagu Seku Kamara said he and his family have begun taking precautions to avoid contracting the Ebola virus.
Ebola is a deadly disease, so we are following the measures, measures that will be given the Ministry of Health and Social Welfare, like preventing tumor handshake, stop eating bush meat, and avoid going to where you know there is an information that is an outbreak. And even if a family member that is very close to you has it, should not get associated with the person until you have a medical advice.
West African authorities and aid organizations say they are taking all possible measures to contain the outbreak. They urge people to act wisely and follow preventative measures. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Wearable sensor devices that look like a stretchable bandage may soon be able to and be available to monitor and treat individuals with certain diseases. VOA's Jessica Berman has our report.
The wearable health monitoring device developed by Korean engineers and described in the journal Nature Nanotechnology looks like a small adhesive bandage with grids of shiny nanowires and other materials on the bottom, closest to the skin. The prototype monitor can be worn on the wrist, continuously gathering and storing physiological activity for up to 1 week. Medications embedded in a silica interface with the flexible electronic device would be administered as necessary. Daehyung Kim is a professor of biological and chemical engineering at Seoul National University. He says researchers envision using the flexible monitor initially to treat people with Parkinson's disease or epilepsy.
And after monitoring the abnormal muscle movement of the patient, we can analyze patterns stored in the memory to analyze the condition of patient. And depending on the condition of the patient, we can control the delivery amount of the embedded drug.
Kim says current wearable health monitors provide accurate information but are bulky. The sensor-laden electronic device his team created would be seamlessly integrated with the skin. In time, Kim says flexible monitors could be designed to keep track of the activity of internal organs, including the heart and brain. Another device could monitor blood glucose levels and infuse insulin automatically. The first experimental monitor, designed to keep track of muscle movements, was successfully tested on pigskin. Kim says he would like to pack other capabilities into the health monitor.
Like wireless power transmission or wireless data transmission, which can communicate with a smartphone and deliver data from the patient side to the hospital.
But before the stretchable monitoring device is ready for human use, Kim says a number of engineering challenges must be overcome, including regulating drug delivery to patients. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Twitter said Monday that it's expanding its social TV efforts with new global partnerships. It struck a deal to acquire companies in Britain and France. Social TV firms Second Sync in Britain and Mezzograph in France announced separately that they were joining Twitter, terms of the deal not announced. The deals come as Twitter announced an expanded effort to be the second screen for TV viewers in countries around the world. That agreement goes beyond Britain and Spain to the Nordics, Russia, parts of Africa, and Southeast Asia. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to the Voice of America today for International Edition. Good to have you with us. A reminder, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineers, Sidrak Franklin and Ashwan Kali, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On April 1st, 1789, the U.S. House of Representatives, meeting in New York City, elected Pennsylvania congressman and Lutheran clergyman Frederick Augustus Conrad Muhlenberg as its first speaker. On this day in 1815, Otto von Bismarck was born. As Prussian prime minister, he helped unify the German states through a combination of war and diplomacy and served as Germany's first chancellor. In 1867, Singapore became a British crown colony. In 1873, the British steamship RMS Atlantic, traveling from Britain to the United States, sank off Canada's Nova Scotia coast in heavy seas. More than 500 people were killed. On this day in 1918, the British Royal Air Force was founded. In 1924, Adolf Hitler was sentenced to 5 years in jail for his participation in the Beer Hall Putsch. He only spent 9 months in jail, but during that time, he wrote his book, Mein Kampf. In 1945, the largest amphibious assault of the Second World War's Pacific Theater occurred as more than 180,000 U.S. soldiers and Marines landed on Okinawa. The operation resulted in heavy casualties on both sides. On this day in 1954, President Dwight David Eisenhower authorized creation of the U.S. Air Force Academy, located near Colorado Springs, Colorado. On April 1st, 1976, high school dropouts Stephen Wozniak and Stephen Jobs formed the Apple Computer Company. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States-China relationship is one of America's most important bilateral relationships, and it will shape global affairs for generations to come. We simply must get it right, the new U.S. ambassador to China said recently to the press. I accepted the position of ambassador to China because I want to be part of helping manage this relationship in the very best possible way. U.S. President Barack Obama nominated Max Baucus to be Ambassador of the United States of America to China on January 7, 2014. He was confirmed by the Senate on February 6. Vice President Biden swore in Ambassador Baucus on February 21. Ambassador Max Baucus was Montana's longest-serving U.S. senator. His tenure began in 1978 and ended in 2013, and he had the third longest tenure among those serving in the U.S. Senate. The first course of action is to strengthen our economic relationship with China in a way that is mutually beneficial and ensures a level playing field for American businesses and workers to compete fairly with their Chinese counterparts, Ambassador Baucus said. The second is to partner with China to tackle common global challenges. We're also urging China to support the laws, the norms, values, and human rights that undergird the current international system from which we all benefit. Ambassador Baucus has extensive experience in international trade. As chairman of the Senate Committee on Finance, Ambassador Baucus led the passage and enactment of free trade agreements with 11 countries, including Australia, Singapore, and South Korea. He also worked to increase U.S. exports by knocking down trade barriers and led business leaders on trade missions to dozens of countries. During his tenure on the Senate Committee on Finance, Ambassador Baucus played a key role in obtaining congressional approval of permanent normal trade relations with China in 2000 and in facilitating China's entrance into the World Trade Organization in 2001. We have much more to gain from cooperation with China than from conflict, Ambassador Baucus emphasized. I see many areas of our relationship where cooperation is not only possible, but it is vital.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.